This is the Monadnock Summer Lyceum, hosted by the Unitarian Universalist Church in Peterborough, New Hampshire, and broadcast on New Hampshire Public Radio. We have some time for questions from the audience. While the ushers collect them, let me begin by asking this. Marjorie, you used the term partway through The Good Guys, one, and then you followed that by inviting us to dissent from who counts as the good guys and bad guys. And so, at least for purposes of this opening question, I'd like to accept that invitation and ask, it's in the particular cases you described, the case of the book in the classroom or in the library, or the professor fired for refusing to sign a loyalty oath, it does seem now pretty clear who the good guys and bad guys were. But I wonder if it's always quite so clear who the good guys and bad guys are. I think many people would, looking at broadcast television today, wonder, to use the title of that book, whether it really was true that we should have some things that are not to be done in front of the kids. And therefore, aren't there real harms occasionally embodied in completely unfettered access to information or stories or other material on the part of kids? And similarly, wasn't it really true that there really were harms embodied, real dangers to American democracy embodied in communism of that Stalinist era? I'm not endorsing those views myself, but I'd want to hear your response to the prospect that there may be real harm sometimes, so in which case the good guys are not always so clear.
Right. Well, that is a long question with several parts. It can take a long time. So let me try to address it without going on too long and start with not in front of the children and the assumption that there's some kind of harm that we can, as a community, recognize caused by exposing children, whatever age we decide to consider, to some category of material which needs to be defined. So one of the purposes of Not in Front of the Children, of my research for that book, of course, was to try to delve into that very common assumption. And two of the problems you come up with right away are, what harm are you talking about, and what material causes it, and to what age group you're addressing your concern? That's actually three questions. And the problem with having a government agency make these decisions is that not everybody's going to agree. I mean, even if you take something like the term pornography and the famous remark by Justice Stewart, "I know it when I see it," the Supreme Court has never been able to define pornography or the legal term for what is still prohibited in most states and by the federal government, obscenity. So the standard, the form of words that government agencies and courts use to define what they consider harmful, and in this case, as the book recounts, obscenity laws began with concerns about harm to minors and other vulnerable people like women and working class people. So there was a very aristocratic and class-based and sex-based kind of hierarchy of who might be harmed or corrupted was the notion. Obscenity laws today are not limited to children or other vulnerable categories, but there are many categories of censorship that are specifically directed at children, and I mentioned the FCC's indecency standard, which is very broad and vague. It includes not just the seven dirty words, on the assumption that children will somehow be corrupted by this. So we're talking about something in the realm of morality rather than any kind of tangible harm. And people are going to differ about what harm might be caused by what category of material to what age group. I mentioned in the talk that when it comes to young children, it's thought that this sexually explicit material, many people think, would be inappropriate. But there's also the question of adolescents and their raging hormones. And there are some who feel, well, they should also be shielded because, what, it's not like their hormones will be suppressed if they're not exposed to whatever is widely available now. So putting aside the practical problems with our current worldwide communication system and the fact that so much sexually explicit material is out there, so that the only practical response to these concerns really ought to be education, because censorship is really only going to be very arbitrary and piecemeal. There's real questions about what role, if any, government should have with respect to censorship in the presumed interests of protecting minors. The ACLU, we used to have these debates between the people who considered themselves First Amendment absolutists and people who thought, yeah, there's some speech that's really harmful, and it's appropriate for the government to provide what we might call censorship. And I was always on the balancing side of that. I didn't think there was any such thing as First Amendment absolutism, because there's many types of speech that are, I think, legitimately prohibited: threats, extortion, perjury, invasions of privacy, harassment, and so forth. But when it comes to these more vague and ineffable concepts like obscenity and indecency, where the harm is not so tangible and easy to identify, and many people disagree, I don't see the basis for an exception to the First Amendment for that. So that was not as short as I hoped, but was there a threat from the Communist Party?
Let me just put that question in the mouth of one of the people from the audience.
Okay.
Because the first question from the audience is actually exactly the same question. Since the opening of Soviet archives, has documented communist infiltration of the State Department, America's premier research facilities, and labor unions, why was it wrong to insist on loyalty oaths when a communist takeover of America would have ended all free speech?
You know, it's an interesting question why the Communist Party emerged by the 1930s in the United States as the most dynamic, aggressive, and effective force for anti-fascism, civil rights, anti-poverty, anti-lynching. They were in the leadership. This was the most dynamic organization around. At the same time, it was a party that answered to Stalin and had some, I think at least you could say, significant illusions about the so-called Soviet utopia at that time. You know, why didn't other more democratically oriented or more groups on the left in the United States that were not beholden to the Soviet Union, why didn't they emerge as the leaders at a time when we're in a Great Depression? Capitalism seems to have failed. People are starving. People are unemployed. Fascism is stalking Europe, and fascism is a powerful force in the United States as well. So people were certainly ready to be organized and to get on the move. And I can't really answer that, except that I think there was an appeal of the Communist Party for lots of idealistic, concerned people. And I talk about that in the book, Priests, especially in New York City, among teachers, largely Jewish population, understandably concerned about fascism. And part of the appeal was it seemed to provide answers. You know, there was this utopia. There was this alternative to the sufferings caused by capitalism. And people came in and out of the Communist Party at a pretty rapid clip because they would get disillusioned by some of the dictates of the party. Or some of you may know about the Nazi-Soviet Pact in 1939, when the Popular Front Against Fascism is suddenly terminated by the fact that Hitler has signed a non-aggression pact with Stalin. So a lot of people got disillusioned and came in and out of the party very fast, but it offered a kind of total world of commitment for people, social, cultural, as well as political. And I think, yeah, there were spies and there was passing of information, much of it probably not of great use to the Soviet Union, but that's not to excuse it. But I think the majority of people who were in and out of the Communist Party or some related group were innocent of anything but the desire to ameliorate some of the injustices that they saw.
So several members of the audience have questions about limits on free speech that are not directly governmental. One person asks, isn't political correctness the current form of censorship? And another asks, it seems now that the decision is what to present on TV rests with advertisers. The possibility of challenging, for example, the violence of TV programs seems difficult, if not impossible. Has the ACLU represented any such challenges of TV violence? So that the question is about limits on expression that are not coming from the government directly, but from either from general public opinion or or advertisers.
Well, a lot of people would say, with some degree of accuracy, I think, that there are greater threats of censorship coming from non-governmental sources. So not from laws, not from school boards, not from police departments, but private universities that have overly broad anti-free speech codes, basically. The highly centralized, conglomerated, private industry media companies that control what we see on cable and broadcasting. So this is not a First Amendment issue. It almost never is a First Amendment issue. First Amendment applies to what the government can and can't do, and what we do to each other in terms of restricting speech or the kinds of self-censorship we may think are appropriate in order to have a civil society, sort of beyond the reach of the Constitution. But it remains a serious issue, and on a lot of campuses, to go back to academic freedom, private university campuses, students are challenging these speech codes. And again, it's a question of balancing. I mean, there have been cases in which, there's a recent case in which a prominent feminist professor wrote an article in which she challenged some of the rules that the university had with respect to faculty-student social relationships. And some students brought a complaint under a federal sex discrimination law that provides that any recipient of federal funds, so private universities, can't discriminate on the basis of sex. So basically a sex discrimination complaint based on the writing of an article. They felt intimidated by the article. So that's an extreme example. And the school, instead of saying, this is not sex discrimination, this is somebody's opinion, the school launched a full-scale investigation of the complaint. I suspect they did that because they felt they wanted to be on the safe side of the federal agencies that regulate this funding law.
Just to follow up a little bit on that, what role does the ACLU take with respect to threats to free expression that are not coming from direct government action, including the last two that you mentioned? Is the ACLU's role, or your own interpretation of that, I'm not asking you to speak for the whole organization, meant to object to governmental intrusions on free speech or to other institutional infringements of free speech?
I think as a matter of law, probably pretty much limited to government, but the ACLU is this largely decentralized organization. It's got affiliates in every state, some states two affiliates. And the state affiliates often go off on different paths than the national organization might choose. But with respect to censorship in the private sector, it would be largely a question of advocacy, public speaking, education. So, for example, in the 90s, I talked about the sex wars. It was really the sex and violence wars, because what you see is, with respect to fears of harm to minors, is with each new technology, there is a renewed fear of adverse consequences. So in the 30s, it was gangster movies, new technology. Before that, in the 1880s, it was crime mysteries and detective stories. Then movies came in and it was movies. When videos came in, remember videotapes? Again, there was a huge fear and violent content that was thought to cause young people, or at least those who were vulnerable, to imitate the heroes or the villains. And it could range from cartoons and Superman to more realistic forms of violence. So a lot of agitation for laws and regulations restricting violence on television, violence in video games, and so forth. And the ACLU took the position that all this was protected by the First Amendment. The jury was completely out, as a matter of social science, on harmful effects versus cathartic effects. Violent entertainment has always been part of our culture since the Odyssey, if not before. But as a private matter, broadcast companies and movie makers can choose to censor themselves. But as you mentioned, they don't often do so because there's a sort of notion that they're giving the public what it wants.
A number of people in the audience are interested in your view. They frame the question in different ways, but your view about the implications of the controversy about the Confederate flag and free expression of views. Can you give your analysis of that?
Sure. Well, the issue of whether the Confederate flag should fly over the South Carolina State House is not really an issue of free speech, because that's what we call government speech. when the government decides to give a message of any kind, it's not required to provide a forum for all other points of view. So would it be unconstitutional for the government to fly the Confederate flag? I don't think anybody has made that claim. But the government of South Carolina is certainly free to take down its Confederate flag. That would not violate anybody's First Amendment rights. With respect to the Confederate flag on T-shirts, underwear, souvenirs, that's probably all First Amendment protected. I think you'd have a very hard time establishing that that amounted to a threat. In certain contexts, it could amount to a threat that could be prohibited or punished. But for the most part, in our legal system, hate speech, if that is considered hate speech, is constitutionally protected. You know, many people, especially Europeans, who have laws against hate speech, which are understandable given their history, are befuddled by the American legal system's protection for hate speech and its prosecution of obscenity and other things that they don't think are so harmful.
But this may be another case in which this issue, which the main threat, if you consider being able to display the Confederate flag as an expression of that ought to be protected by free speech, then this may be another case in which the main threats actually to that freedom, if it is a legitimate freedom, are coming from the government, but from, in fact, private businesses, you know, as stores refuse now to sell objects that have the Confederate flag on them. And I suppose the same question would be asked here. Is there any role of defenders of civil liberties in being critical of stores or, you know, firms for removing that opportunity from people to be able to express those views?
I think that's very tricky. And we had those debates at the ACLU, and some of you may remember the fatwa against Salman Rushdie.
Right.
So this is an extreme example of censorship pressure. We're not talking about a picket line or a boycott. We're talking about death threats for the publication or distribution of a book. It's all done privately in terms of publishers, bookstore owners, fearful, not wanting to sell the book or publish it. So who should prevail in that situation? The publishers and the bookstore owners have their own rights to decide not only what they want to distribute, what they want to be associated with, but something to do with the safety of their employees. But on the other side, there is a censorship effect, a powerful censorship effect. So I suspect from the debates we had over not only the fatwa, which is a dramatic case, but, for example, boycotts that would be organized, either by Christian evangelical groups against a play that they thought was blasphemous, or a women's rights group against a play they thought was misogynist. I think people took very different positions within the ACLU as to whether those who were advocating the boycott, their rights should prevail over the rights of the play, the theater producers, the authors, to have their work not subjected to private censorship pressures. So this is a conflict that goes on and on.
Several members of the audience would like to take advantage of the fact that they have a distinguished law professor before them to ask questions about related, though not identical, issues. One of them turns on the issue of religious freedom, also part of the Bill of Rights. What do you think is the future for the religious freedom movement in reaction to the recent Supreme Court rulings on same-sex marriage? Here I think the issue is, could the government, which has now made same-sex marriage possible, then begin to enforce that on churches or religious clergy people to require them to perform same-sex marriages?
Well, one thing you learn when you're in the trenches doing constitutional litigation is the Supreme Court is not always perfectly consistent. So, you know, if it were an issue of race discrimination, and I had this case years ago at the Massachusetts ACLU involving a landlord who had a religious objection to, and this was not a gay couple, this was a heterosexual unmarried couple. He had a religious objection to unmarried couples. And so that violated the Massachusetts anti-discrimination law. If it had been a religious objection to an interracial couple, I have no doubt that the state Supreme Court would have upheld the right of the couple to rent the apartment. But since it was a question of marital status, the state Supreme Court upheld the right of the landlord to discriminate against them on religious grounds. So fast forward to what we're confronting now, I think if it were a case of interracial marriage, putting aside churches, where the Supreme Court is not going to start interfering with religious belief, but in the area of restaurants, hotels, wedding cakes, public accommodations of all kinds, the courts, I think, would uphold the right of the interracial couple to have access to those services in conformity with anti-discrimination laws. But I don't think that's going to happen with respect to same-sex couples. And some of you may be familiar with this Hobby Lobby decision, which many of us consider bizarre. A religious objection by a large for-profit corporation with thousands and thousands of employees objecting to a provision of the Affordable Care Act that did not require them even to fund contraceptive services, but if they had an objection to funding contraceptive services, to fill out a form which would have provided that contraceptive services would be provided by other sources. They had a religious objection to that, and the Supreme Court upheld that. Many people found that to be shocking. But it's an indication of at least how the current Supreme Court, I think, would address religious objections to same-sex marriage.
Well, that's a wonderful end to a complicated, interesting discussion. Thank you again, Marjorie Helms, for sharing your time with us and your expertise with us today.
My pleasure.
You have been listening to the Mannadnack Summer Lyceum on New Hampshire Public Radio. The Mannadnack Summer Lyceum presents a weekly series of lectures held at the Unitarian Universalist Church in Peterborough, New Hampshire. For more information about the Lyceum, you can visit our website at www.mannadnacklyceum.org. The program next Sunday will feature underwater archaeologist Warren Reese speaking about the ship that held up Wall Street. Thank you again, Marjorie Hines, for a wonderful talk. Now, please join us for one more time with Marjorie Hines and for refreshments in the parish hall, which has been most generously provided by Peterborough's French bakery, C'est la Vie. I'd like to take this opportunity to thank the United Universalist Church's Social Justice Committee, which provided today's flowers. I'd also like to thank David Fleming, who did the sound editing for us today. If you ask a question that was not answered during the program, please feel free to ask it during the reception. We'd also like to hear from you about your experience today, and we encourage you to fill out the blue card. Thank you so much for coming.